Welcome to Local Talk on KHY Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Pottock, one of your hosts for today, together with my co-host, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for joining us to listen in.
This year is the fifth anniversary that KHOI Radio has been on the air, and we began our celebrations at this year's 4th of July parade in downtown Ames. KHOI had a big presence in the parade with banners celebrating our various radio programs, a decorated truck, and a band of boomboxes playing KHOI music programming. Here's a big thank you to all of those who made our parade a success, including all of our sponsors, the residents of Eastwood Apartments, Cafe DM for providing coffee, Beloit of Lutheran Services of Ames, ISU's Descarga Latin Dance Club, ISU's United Native American Student Association, the Meskwaki Drummers, Singers, and Dancers, and the people who loaned trucks for the parade. And thanks, too, for all of the KHOI volunteers and program hosts who made it work, with special thanks to the organizers Valerie Vila, Wendy Mesa, Malik Davis, and to Paul Hertz for leading the parade with his trombone. And a big thank you to Pat Schlarbaum for all the carpentry work he did making the banners for the parade. And a big thank you to the Main Street Cultural District for partnering with us on this 4th of July celebration.
A bit later in the program, we'll be getting onto other topics, including the recent demonstration in Des Moines against the Bakken pipeline and research on honeybees. But right now, we'll stay with the Independence Day celebrations. With all the noise of fireworks, this past Independence Day produced some very unhappy and stressed dogs. However, there was one group of dogs that had an absolutely wonderful time. It was a special dog-centered event seen here in Ames for the first time this year, a canine aquatic competition known as Dock Dogs, in which dogs jump off a dock into a tank of water. Ames dog owners came out in large numbers to show their furry friends the best time they've had for quite a while. Ursula went to check it out and came back with this report.
This is the sound of happy dogs. And this is the sound of people being happy by making dogs happy.
Go, Canyon! Get the pepper! Canyon, go get the pepper!
There you
go, Canyon! Go, 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 go! Go, Canyon! Go, 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 go! Get that pepper! Get that pepper, Canyon! Go, pull, 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 pull!
Come on, Canyon! Give him some love, Canyon! Give him some love! I got a bit of a
sick. Good job, Canyon!
During the July 4th celebrations, a dog dock diving event has come to Ames. This is Ursula Rudenberg, and never having seen such a thing, I've come to check it out. There are quite a few people here, and there's quite a few dogs watching who are not competing. I didn't expect to find such a big rig, an enormous and deep pool of very inviting water is taking up half of the block of Kellogg between 5th and 6th Street in downtown Ames. And leading up to one end of the pool is a large dock about 8 feet off the ground. And one at a time, dog owners come up on the dock with a dog who then, after careful preparation, jumps into the water and either swims or leaps after a white object, which they call the bumper.
And they're shooting out of the box.
That's a very fast reaction time. 0.211. Elapsed time 8.026. Fastest dog in this wave.
Your dog is a competitor?
Yes, he is.
What's his name?
Oscar.
And where's Oscar from?
Ames, Iowa.
So is Oscar a first-time competitor?
First-time competitor.
Did he like it?
Yeah, he loves it. He likes to swim.
Did he understand it?
Seems to.
What's your dog's name?
Tilly.
How old is Tilly?
6 months.
And she's a black lab?
Yep, black Labrador, yep.
And where's Tilly from?
Tilly's from Ames, Iowa. She's local. First time ever competing today. It was a lot of fun.
And you're from Ames?
Yeah, from Ames. Actually a coach up at Iowa State for track. It's like, oh, long jump for dogs. So that makes a lot of sense. So we're excited.
How did you explain to Tilly what she was supposed to do?
We threw the toy in the water and she went after it. Tilly loves water, so it didn't take much convincing. I think she's got a lot to learn still. We got some pointers from the experts out here, and that was kind of cool. It's kind of a neat community.
What was was like the main advice they gave you?
It's a personal competition for the dog. Don't get caught up with what other people are doing. And
this is really right up her alley, isn't it?
Right up her alley. Sport. It's a lot of fun. She did it by herself at the lake, so finally might as well bring her out here. And
sounds like she wants to go again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She's very jealous of these dogs right now getting to go in the water. So, yep. So.
What's your dog's name?
This is Rigby.
Are you from around here?
No, I'm from Wellsville, Kansas. It's just south of Kansas City.
You didn't come up for this, did you?
That's all.
Wow. You traveled from Kansas?
We went out to Vail a couple weeks ago and to Osage Beach about, 2 weeks ago, and wherever there's an event. So my other dog, Canyon, has qualified for Worlds, so, which is in Knoxville, Tennessee, in October.
She's paying a lot of attention to everything.
She is. She loves it.
Do you enjoy it?
Oh, I love it. Them enjoying it is what makes it fun. That's what's all that's important. If they jump far, that's great. If they swim fast, that's great. But as long as they're having fun, that's all that matters. All you have to have is toy drive for this. So I have 10 dogs, and only 3 of them have the toy drive. And only 3 of them want to jump in the water.
Etsy is a Dutch Shepherd. She is a reverse brindle. She is very lovable, unlike most shepherds. She loves to cuddle, but she is toy crazy ever since she was a puppy.
She's a talented dog.
Yes, she is. She has the best score out of all our dogs, so I'd say yes.
She likes doing it?
Yes, and we got her a new ball. It's really squeaky, and she goes crazy for any ball, no matter if it's hers or not.
Where are you from?
I am from here in Ames, Iowa.
Have you done these competitions a lot?
This is my 5th year.
Wow.
Yes.
So you started really young.
I started the soonest any youth handler can at 7.
At 7.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Well, congratulations. And she looks like a really nice dog, too.
She is. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Some 360s? You want me to go swimming, Daddy? That's just water. There it is, a big leap and a swim. His dog wants to make the chase down to the far end of the pool. Is he going to pull the bumper? Yes. One more. Yes. Another one. Complete time, 21.281.
Those are some of the sounds of excited dog and dog lovers from the event itself. And now here's an explanation about it from Sam Moeller of ISU's Model Farm, who brought the event to Ames.
This is a 2-day event. The company is called Doc Dogs, and they're the ones who kind of run the dog jumping competitions. They do them all over the U.S. They did one here in Ames on the 3rd and 4th of July. They came in on the morning of the 3rd and set up all day, and there was a little bit of a show at night on the 3rd and then pretty much all day on the 4th.
Now, this dock jumping, it involves dogs jumping off a dock into water, right?
Yeah.
So it's more common on the coasts, I imagine, and by lakes and things.
I think it's actually kind of all over the U.S.
Uh-huh.
They're based out of Ohio, and it's kind of like an Olympics for dogs. 3 different events. There's an event for how far they can jump into a pool called Big Air, and then there's Extreme Vertical. It's kind of like a high jump for dogs. They see how high they can jump. And then a speed retrieve where they see how fast they can jump in and swim to the end of the pool and grab a buoy.
It's a dog athletic event.
Yep.
And presumably the dogs really like to do it, do they?
Yeah, the dogs really like. They got to get trained to do it.
Uh-huh.
Some don't jump in the water, but ones that are trained, they can really get out there.
And how do they know? How do you let them know that you want them to jump high or long jump or what kind of jumping you want them to do? Can you measure the height? I can see the width, but how do you measure the height?
So it's kind of just like for the extreme vertical, it's kind of like a high jump pole. They just like keep putting they just keep putting the toy higher and higher up. So,
and the dog, so the dog is jumping over to retrieve a toy.
Yep, that's what it is. That's how they get them to go in the water, is the dogs want to get the toy.
I see. Yeah, and they presumably just like to do it anyway.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, there must be special breeds of dogs that are better at this, I imagine. My dog, I've got a Newfie, and she wouldn't like to jump. She likes water, but she wouldn't like jumping.
Actually, any dog can jump in it. They have a lot of different divisions, kind of like amateur, all the way up to like semi-pro and pro. And I don't know if they're based on like different sizes of dogs, but I know there's a bunch of different divisions versus like somebody who would just kind of bring their dog in for a first time compared to someone who's trained their dog and they've been doing it for a while.
But presumably these big, big, heavy breeds like St. Bernards and Bernese Mountain Dogs and things like that, they wouldn't be good at it, presumably.
Maybe not.
Yeah, and I don't think Newfies would either. She's good at long-distance swimming, or she was when she was younger. But okay, so which turned out to be the winning breeds or the winning dogs?
I don't know what breed the winning dog was, but I do know the winning dog in the pro division, I believe, his jump was like 21 feet.
This is a long jump.
Yep, he jumped
21 feet.
Yep, 21
that
feet.
That is huge. Yeah, and they have a big long run to get to it?
Yeah, I think there's like a 40-foot dock that they run and jump off of, and then they jump into a 40-foot pool.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we're talking about dog dock jumping. One of the things that I kept hearing about from dog owners at this event was the concept of toy drive. It seemed to be the operating principle behind all this fun and competition. So I got curious about it, and I called the MC and manager of the event, who was here in Ames at the time. Steve Sanchez is originally from Los Angeles, but he's traveling with this event and managing it. And when I reached him by phone, he was in Independence, Iowa, setting up for a new competition there. I asked Steve what exactly Toy Drive is.
Toy Drive is just kind of that one thing that gets you going in the canine world. Big obsession or desire for whatever their favorite toy is. It could be a tennis ball, a bumper, a rubber duck. You know, that one thing, for some dogs, it's a rope and they love to play tug. And then you pull out the tennis ball and they're like, no, I don't really care for that. So for these dogs, they're trained to have that toy drive. When they do something good, you reward them with their toy. They walk off for 5 minutes, you take that toy back, and you wait for them to do something good again. You give them their toy right back. Here's your toy. So, hey, I did good. Mom and Dad are happy. And so am I. It's like, oh my gosh, here we go. Woohoo. You know, we're at Disneyland. This is the best time of our life. So toy drive is really just all about how much desire do you have.
When the dogs were getting ready to jump off the dock and grab what you call a bumper, which is kind of like a white.
It's almost just like if you take a boat and you have the bumpers that go on the side mm-hmm. when you dock them.
Yeah.
And just shrink it down 100 times, that's pretty much the main toy we see in our sport.
When they come up on the dock, a lot of them are pointing their noses at it and staring at it, crying. And
that's all they want, exactly. For some dogs, we see some dogs come up, and they can really care less if mom and dad have the toy in their hand. And you can notice it when the dog makes their leap. The dog will not watch the toy and look at the water and go for a swim. And then after, okay, I'll go grab it because I know that's what mom and dad want me to do. The fun was jumping in the water, yeah.
The toy drive makes the dog more competitive, right?
Correct. Everybody that is at the top of their class, they all have toy drive.
Some of these dogs tried very hard. There was this one dog, Etsy. She jumped many, 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 many times. She outdid herself.
Yeah, higher than she had ever gone before.
So when they're doing that, are they doing that for the toy or are they doing it to please their owner?
A little bit of both. So a dog like Etsy is a dog that has a desire to make you happy. They want to please their owner in any way that they can. That's just with her breed. A lot of the shepherd breeds, these dogs have a fire for pleasing their owner because they get a sense of confidence from doing work. And mm-hmm. so when mom and dad are happy, a lot of times the shepherd breed is ecstatic because that means that for the most part, they're doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a dog like Etsy, it's both. It's a ton of toy drive and it's also just kind of being a shepherd. You know, they don't want to leave any option not turned over. You know, hey, did I do exactly what you wanted me to?
You've explained the dogs a little bit to us. What have you observed about the people who do this?
To be completely honest, since I've been in the sport going on 3 seasons now, I have found that our competitors are some of the most dog-driven people in the world. They truly live for and love their animals. If I was a dog, that's where I would want to spend my time with those avid competitors because they find the things that their dogs like and they do them. Whatever it is that makes that dog happy and gives that dog confidence or a sense of entitlement of, hey, this is me and this is what I like to do.
So you're saying that the dogs, when they jump and they're trying to please their owners, are you saying the owners are also trying to please the dogs?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
So one of the funnest things in watching the competition is everybody has their own style of talking to the dog to prepare it to jump. One of the people always kissed the top of the dog's head. The owner is trying to support the dog there.
Correct.
Hoping that
yes.
the dog
trying
will
to encourage that dog, trying to let that dog know that you know, everything that's happening up here is good and fun, and you're going to get this toy, all that excitement. I'm going to let you unleash it right now. You know, you can do this, buddy. Let's go get your best jump ever. So win or lose, strikeout or home run, buddy, you're still, you know, you're still the best dog in my book. You know, mm-hmm. during those meetings, you get to see what kind of owner that person is. On the other side of that, you also kind of get to see the dog's mentality and kind of their perspective on things. Some dogs will sit there and yell at mom and dad, like, okay, I know, throw it. And other dogs will sit there and be like, all right, Dad, I know the routine. We'll walk through it. I'll be patient. I'll be quiet. You know, I've done this for a long time. That is definitely a cool part of the sport.
What have you learned from doing all this?
How much enjoyment these dogs get from it, I never knew existed. I come from just outside the city of Los Angeles. We don't have lakes and ponds and rivers and, you know, we're not out in the country. We don't have tons of squirrels running up our trees and, you know, rodents or cattle for these dogs to herd. And so in my city, I tend to see a lot of dogs that are maybe working class dogs or even Labradors and Goldens that have bad behavioral problems. And it's not because they're bad dogs. It's just because they're not getting to do the things that they need to do. Things that are going to make that dog happy and fulfill it and get it to be the best dog that it can be. Like I say, from where I come from, I see tons of dogs that aren't getting whatever it is that they're looking for. You know, I would say if anything, this sport has taught me, one, how much cool things there are out there, what these dogs can actually are capable of. If you would have told me a dog jumped 31 feet, you know, when I started this, or actually when they did tell me that, I laughed and I said, you're kidding. That's impossible. A dog can't jump that far. And it's not forcibly, it's totally under their will. They totally want to go out there and be as athletic, as fearless as they can be. These dogs are flying.
With this competition, you clearly get the impression that people are doing exactly what the dogs want us to be doing.
Oh, correct. I reference a lot of time, who's training who here, you know? Is the dog training the dad? Is the dad training the dog? I don't know.
Yes.
And that's because these dogs have the high drive. And that's why we accept anybody and everybody. That's why we have a zero discrimination policy, because, you know, we have certain rules in place that actually keep our dogs separated from each other so that we don't have to tell a dog that maybe doesn't like getting sniffed by other dogs, hey, you can't compete here because you don't like another dog coming up and sniffing your rear end. Mm-hmm. You can't jump here with us.
Mm-hmm.
So we even have rules in place for the dog that a lot of people would say, oh, they're a lost cause.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in our eyes, that dog maybe just hasn't found what they were built for. Maybe that dog just needs this opportunity here. Dogs are dogs, and everyone, like humans, they deserve a fair shot.
Do you ever see a dog being abused at these shows by their owner?
You know what? I have never seen that whatsoever. And we have, as far as the staffing goes, it is a big no-no. But I have never seen anything abusive. I have never seen a dog panting, needing water, needing air, mm-hmm. needing shelter. I've never seen a hungry dog. I've never seen a dog be kicked or smacked.
Have you ever seen a dog being reprimanded for failing?
No, never. Never at all. For the most part, our competitors know that if they reprimand the dog for failure, that dog starts to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And that dog starts to think that it did something very, very wrong, and they don't even want to test those waters again. To be completely honest with you, if anybody has a problem with anything, it's typically the new competitor. It's the person that's never done it before. It's the person that, say, well, can I just push the dog in? Absolutely not. You can't push the dog in. It's pretty much our only rule. We have two rules on Doc Dogs, and it's a zero push policy. You cannot push your dog or nudge your dog in the water in any way, shape, or form. And secondly, your dog's got to be 6 months or older. And other than that, you can come out here and jump with us. It doesn't matter, regardless of age, size, shape, breed, ability. You can come out and jump with us if you can keep yourself from pushing your dog in the water.
Is it your impression that the dogs know when they win?
There's a small group of dogs that do know. As weird as it sounds, there's a handful of dogs that they seem to know, hey, I'm down by 5 inches. I need to make it up right here. And they will somehow go and get, you know, 6 or 7 mornings when you thought they couldn't go any farther, or they haven't gone that far all weekend, and now they need to, and it's the last chance for them to. There is probably a good 20 teams out there that I feel like that dog knows.
Mm-hmm.
That dog knows that it's got 3 inches to gain, and it's got to get it or it's not going to win. And they will throw that last ditch effort and everything into it at that one instance. For the most part, everybody else is out there just to have fun. They don't really know if they're doing good or not. They're just kind of doing their best every time. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just trying to get that bumper as quickly as they can. And our top competitors out there in the world, they have crazy toy drive.
There's no ceremony that to signify to the dog that they're the winner.
No, there's not. For the most part, everybody that jumps in our competition, 99.9% of them, they are all literally out there to have fun. So whether I say first, second, or third in front of their name, they really don't care. It's mm-hmm. really like, cool, we came out, we had fun, good weather, great crowds. When the handler goes home saying, hey, we stayed on time, the schedule worked, my dog had a great time, I'm a happy camper. First, mm-hmm. second, or third don't mean anything to me.
And finally, what have you observed about the crowds that watch these events?
You know, I used to do a good amount of work for companies like Nike and Red Bull and do some other events that are a good time. However, I've never worked anywhere or doing anything that quite literally anybody and everybody that walks by it either stops and drops their jaw or they just have the biggest smile on their face. I've never worked for an organization that gets so many compliments from such a vast and a wide range of people. It's not just, you know, a particular group. There are very few people in this world that don't like dogs. Quite frankly, it has nothing to do with any of us. It has everything to do with just the dog and seeing, you know, how truly athletic and remarkable some of these dogs actually are.
This is very, very charming because it's clear that this is not just for the people.
Correct. This is all about the dog. I have, you know, one of the biggest teams in the sport, one of the big pioneer in the sport. His name is Tom Dropic. He has a handful of dogs. Every time he gets up on the stage, if you call his name a little too much, he's real quick to remind you, you need to start talking about my dog more. This is all about Remy, mm-hmm. you know, and that's a good example of it right there. Of, you know, one of our top competitors, a guy who has world records and world championships. He's really quick to remind the spectators, hey, this is all about Remy. Remy gets it done, and it's all about him. It has nothing to do with me.
Thanks for coming to Ames and giving us all a really great time. It was just a really
awesome,
natural and relaxing way that you did it that made it real fun to be part of.
Cool.
Thank you.
Cool. I'm glad you felt that. I had a blast, and we're already talking about next year, so I'm looking forward to it.
So where are you right now?
Cedar Rapids, because tomorrow morning we're going to wake up and go into Independence and set up for the weekend.
You may or may not see some of the same dogs there?
I will see most likely a good handful of the same dogs. Mm-hmm. Some people follow us around pretty much year-round all across the States, Canada, England, and Australia as well. We only slow down for about 2 months out of the year during the holidays, during Christmas and New Year's. It's kind of a lottery. You don't know who you're going to get. You might get mm-hmm. some 10-year competitors, or you might get, like, this last two-day competition. You might get yourself 64 on-site registrations.
That was Ames?
Yeah, that
wow.
was Ames.
So there was a lot yes. of new dogs here.
Lots of new dogs. Typically, 20, 25, 30 new dogs is a lot.
Do you set this up yourself, or do you have a crew?
Just myself, my judge, just the two of us, and we literally set up the whole dock and the whole pool.
Where did the water come from?
The water actually came from the fire hydrant right on the corner. Fire department came out and opened it up for us.
You were able to leave it there at night?
Correct. The police department, being that they were just right around the block, they said, you know what, we'll drive by just about every 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, it was an awful tempting body of water, for sure.
I know.
Have you ever swum in it?
On setup days, you know, if it's real hot and, you know, competitors aren't in yet and there's no dogs in the region yet and we're kind of done setting up and it's super hot, yeah, we'll take a dip and cool off before we head out of town.
Thanks, and best of luck to you.
Awesome. Thank you very much. You have a good day.
Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Steve Sanchez with Doc Dogs Company giving us some background on dog psychology behind dock diving. It was a terrific addition to the 4th of July celebrations here in Ames. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg, along with my co-host, Kay Patak.
Along with parades, fireworks, cookouts, dog diving, another thing we associate with summer is bees. Bees have been in the news a lot recently because bee populations have been declining in many areas, and those declines have an impact on the roles bees play as pollinators of important crops, as well as on the amount of honey produced by honeybees. A group of Iowa State researchers are studying prairie habitat and honeybees in Iowa, and their research group recently received a $1 million grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to further the project. We have with us today Dr. Amy Toth, Associate Professor in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Organismal Biology in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at Iowa State, and also associated with the Department of Entomology or Insects, Entomology. Welcome, Amy, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
To start off, could you tell us why bee populations are in trouble and declining? Do they know exactly the different reasons?
I wish I had a simple answer for you. It's a very complex problem, and there has been a lot of ongoing research into the decline of bee populations. One thing that I do want to clarify is that when we're speaking about population declines of bees, we need to distinguish between native bees that are found in each area. So, for example, here in Iowa, some people have been doing recent surveys, and it seems that we have over 200 different species of bees here in Iowa. The honeybee has been imported from Europe and is not native to Iowa. We are seeing global declines in pollinator populations across the world, including all kinds of different species of wild bees. But along with that, we're also seeing that managed honeybees are also having a lot of health problems. And it's been harder and harder for beekeepers to keep their colonies alive. So when we're speaking of population declines, there are some common factors that could be influencing both the managed bees as well as the wild bees. And a number of studies are pointing to several different factors. So to finally get to your question, it seems that there are many stressors in the environment that are negatively affecting bee health. Certainly, pesticides are in the news a lot, and people are very concerned about pesticide issues. There's a lot of ongoing research on that. There's no doubt that pesticides negatively affect bees of all types, whether it's bumblebees, sweat bees, or honeybees. Insecticides are designed to kill insects, and although some are more specific than others, there's certainly an ample evidence that a lot of pesticides are killing bees. So pesticides in the environment certainly are an issue. Proper and safe use of pesticides can help reduce those impacts greatly. Another factor that we've become really interested in is forage availability. So bees are pollinators. They forage on flowers for nectar and pollen, and that's where they exclusively get their food from. And even just looking at the landscape over the course of my lifetime or anyone's lifetime, you can see a change in that landscape. So we're seeing increasingly few wild areas in many areas of agricultural intensification as well as urbanization. And that has led to a loss of the number of flowers, but also the diversity of flowers that are present for bees to forage on. And many bees, including honeybees, which are of primary concern to a lot of people because they are the number one pollinator in the world, they're generalists. They will forage on many different species of flowers. They prefer to forage on a diverse range of flowers. And if they are force-fed a single type of pollen or nectar, we've been doing these types of experiments, we see that their health suffers. So they actually need a good, diverse, broad diet of different types of
like
flowers.
Like people and everyone.
Exactly. And then the third issue that has been raising a lot of concern is disease. And along with globalization, there have been new pests, parasites, and pathogens that have been brought in that can have very strong negative impacts on bees. So one devastating parasite that affects honeybees is the Varroa destructor mite. And this has been an ongoing issue for several decades now, but it's still a major issue in honeybee health. But they also, the mites are associated with a whole host of diseases that can negatively impact bees. For example, viral diseases are of primary concern right now and something that we're researching. So there are some viruses that the bees can get from mites. There's also concern that the honeybees can be transmitting these viruses to other species of bees. So there are many stressors. Many of them seem to be almost inescapable in the environment, and what we're primarily concerned with is the interaction between these stressors. And so what we found in some of our previous work is that bees are able to withstand, let's say, one type of stress. If they're already healthy, they have a good diet, and then you infect them with a virus, they can fight that virus off. But if they're weakened by pesticide stress or if they're weakened by nutritional stress, then it's going to be really hard for them to fight off the disease. So these interactions seem to be one of the main issues.
You mentioned pesticides. Well, I've been hearing a bit about is that how you pronounce it?
Neonicotinoids.
Yeah. Are those especially bad?
That's a class of pesticides that has received a lot of attention. And there is a lot of variation in what people are reporting out there as far as the impact of neonicotinoids. If we kind of take a historical perspective, the neonicotinoids are actually a lot less severe than pesticides that were used in the past.
Oh, okay.
And as far as their toxicity to bees and other non-target insects, beneficial insects. However, there's concern that because they're so pervasively used that they are everywhere. So they're not just on the leaves of the plants. The seed treatments that are used commonly in corn and soybeans, the seed treatment can actually get into the groundwater, get into the soil, get into the plants. And so there's concern that low-level exposure that is chronic could erode bee health. Again, like this sort of presenting an additional stress. As far as acute kills from neonicotinoids, there are some reports of that during planting season due to the dust, the airborne dust that's associated with planting of corn and soybean seeds. But people are also now looking at this sort of low-level chronic exposure. Mm-hmm. And it seems to depend. And so there are some studies, a recent study just came out last week, suggesting that it depends on the environment, which area, which region of the world that you're looking at. And it also depends on other types of stressors that might be interacting with those pesticides. So in some cases, crop fields, which are maybe treated with neonicotinoids, can provide forage for bees. And so the negative impact of the neonicotinoid could be counterbalanced by good forage. On the other hand, if there are other stressors present in the environment and these neonicotinoids can have negative impacts, then we can see that they will have effects on bee health. So they're certainly of concern. I think there's been perhaps a very strong focus on neonicotinoids as the killer of the bees, and it's not that simple. It's not just if we ban neonicotinoids, we'd solve all the problems of bee health. Certainly there is a reason for concern, however.
Okay, now talking of banning, do you think communities should take any kind of action to protect the environment from bee-killing pesticides?
Absolutely. So I think that there should certainly be regulations in place, and there are regulations in place about the proper use of pesticides and applying pesticides in a way that should avoid direct contact with bees. So you can apply them, for example, very, very early in the morning or late at night when the bees are not foraging, doing it when wind conditions are low, so to prevent blowover that could get onto other plants that the bees might be foraging on.
Yeah.
And so I think that if people are following the rules and how they're using pesticides, that can certainly help the problem.
Now, the research you've been doing and the grant you received focused on the weight of honey beehives. What exactly will you be studying, and why is the weight of the hives important?
Sure. So the weight of the hive is actually a very crude metric of colony health. We're looking at many different factors, but that one actually seems to be a very good predictor of colony health. So what we typically expect to see is throughout the course of the season that beehives gain weight. So they may start off small in the spring because they've just been through winter. And they've downsized. Some of the bees perhaps have died. And in spring, they start off rather small. In spring, under good conditions, they should build up rapidly, produce lots and lots more bees, and start collecting and hoarding honey. So honeybees are hoarders. They are the ultimate hoarders of nectar, and they convert that into honey, and it is very heavy. And so what we should see in a healthy colony is a strong buildup of their weight. Mostly
so it's not
as a result
of
honey
stores.
The bees
that's the weight, it's the honey.
It's partially, but it's more directly correlated with the weight of the honey.
Okay.
And so we can look at that increase, and then what we've been seeing over the past several years is that the honey stores actually are a good predictor of the colony's overall state of health. So those that have more honey tend to also have more bees, tend to also be producing more young bees, the brood of the colony. And so these things seem to be well correlated with the colony weight. But we are looking at a number of other factors as well. We're looking at the individual bees' health, So we can measure how much fat they have in their bodies. We can measure the disease loads they have in their bodies and get an indicator of the strength of the individual bee as well. So we will be looking at a number of factors, but hive weight seems to be a fairly good predictor of colony success.
And presumably when people take out the honey, if they do, they should obviously leave a lot of – are they leaving enough honey for the bees?
Right. So I think any good beekeeper knows that they need to leave them their honeybee hives with an ample amount of honey to survive the winter. And typically what – in an ideal situation, a beekeeper would manage their hives in a way that the bees are so healthy that they would produce excess honey, and then they would only take the amount that was
needed
– or that you felt was excess, and then leave the bees with ample honey stores to survive the winter. And so that's always been the model for beekeepers. What we're seeing is the most striking thing in our data is that at the end of the season, the honeybee hives are losing weight drastically. And we do expect them to downsize to some extent towards the end of the season in preparation for winter. But what we're seeing is a crash at the end of the season. And there appears to be almost nothing in the environment for them to forage on.
Because they mostly use soybean flowers.
They are using soybean flowers to some extent during soybean bloom for nectar, but that's actually a very short window.
Sure.
And the primary source of forage is clover, which we consider to be a weed in many cases. And so these bees seem to really like these clovers, but the clovers also die down a lot at the end of the season. So we're seeing this massive crash in colony weight and bee population, and then they're going into the winter very small and very weak and potentially with not enough honey stores to get through the winter. So this seems to be the primary issue that we're hoping to address with our prairie component of our project, which is when you look at an agricultural area or an urban area, there's not a lot of forage late in the season. But if you go to a prairie late in the season, there are actually plenty of different species of flowers that are blooming the late summer and fall. And the idea is that if we can put honeybees on these prairies, that perhaps we can rescue their health back before they have to go into the overwintering season.
So we're running out of time here, but if we can just summarize quickly, this all links up with prairie restoration. Right?
Yes. So one of the things that we'd like to do is consider whether we could integrate prairies into agricultural systems, small scale. So if there could be some way to pair up both agricultural production, which is key, and also conservation.
Right.
And so can we use native plantings of prairie plants that will bloom well throughout the season to provide ample forage and then potentially buffer bees against other stressors that they might encounter in the environment? And we have some preliminary data that's very exciting that shows that bees that are taken out of this stressful environment of an agricultural field and placed into a prairie late in the season show an amazing rebound in their hive weight.
Okay.
And so it looks very promising that this could make a huge impact.
Okay. Well, that's a good note to end on.
And we're speaking with Amy Toth from Iowa State University about bees. Thank you for coming, Amy.
Thank you.
Let's have a music break real quick.
Sometimes it takes a rainy day just to let you know everything's gonna be I need a little piece of
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts today with K-Paw Talk. Last Saturday, July 1st, at the Des Moines Capitol Building, a rally was held against the Dakota Access Pipeline. The rally was sponsored by Indigenous Iowa, Little Creek Camp, Bold Iowa, Climate March, Iowa Hemp Association, and other organizations. People at the rally were calling for three actions: that the Iowa Utilities Board be told to revoke the Dakota Access permit immediately in light of the recent federal court's ruling in favor of the Standing Rock Sioux, stating that the existing Army Corps of Engineer environmental impact statement was not adequate. And second, that Governor Reynolds be told to appoint someone other than the recent Richard Lozier, who was appointed by Governor Branstad to the Iowa Utilities Board. And finally, that Iowans continue to watch the pending Iowa Supreme Court case challenging the Utilities Board's use of eminent domain for claiming land to lay the pipeline. Pipeline owner Energy Transfer Partners could be required to stop flowing the oil and dig up the pipeline if that was the case. We have with us today in the studio Christine Nobis and LaKasha. They're from the main organizers of the Saturday rally, Indigenous Iowa. Who were you actually addressing with what the rally was calling for?
Well, we had a petition to go to Kim Reynolds. So there was her and the Iowa Utilities Board, of course, and also, I guess, really the Supreme Court.
The Iowa Supreme Court.
Yes.
Because there's a case pending at the Iowa Supreme Court.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it was, pressure on the ground to support the case that was going on.
Yeah.
Regarding. And the court is challenging the use of eminent domain to provide the land for the pipeline. Is
yes.
that correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That and the permit, too.
Mm-hmm. That's right. The permit to actually have the pipeline. Who emceed the event in Des Moines?
All of us, actually.
All of you?
Yes.
Okay.
The event was a little chaotic in its organization, just because we did have an MC that was supposed to come, but he couldn't make it. So we all just took turns.
Uh-huh.
Ed Fallon was up there sometimes. I was up there. LaKasha was up there sometimes. We just all took turns.
And was there a good response to the demonstration, or what kind of a response did you get?
It was a great response. I think we had about, over 100 people.
Yeah, probably 80 to 100. The initial response, though, with the sheriff arrived because we went up on the drove up on the sidewalk, unloaded our solar panels that was powering the PA system, and there was confusion on the permit as well for us to be there. I think the comment was made, though. We need a permit to rally as United States citizens or Iowa citizens, Des Moines citizens, and the Dakota Access Pipeline. They need a permit also. So,
LaKasha, you are with Indigenous Iowa as well. Is that correct?
Yes, mm-hmm. I guess so. Yeah.
As of this moment, do you anticipate or did you get any response from the Iowa legislature or the governor after the demonstration?
Not yet.
So tell us a little bit about Indigenous Iowa. LaKasha, you came from Standing Rock, where you were before this,
mm-hmm.
and as I understand it, and helped build Little Creek Camp.
Yes, I was at Standing Rock from September through late February when the National Guard came through, and then I brought supplies down to found Little Creek Camp. That was quite a journey in itself, considering what it's related to is a war zone. As a Marine Corps vet, it's very similar.
Can you explain?
With the National Guard coming in and the oppressive nature of the corporate forces, to include DAPL, hired mercenaries, you know, with Tiger Swan, which is formerly known as Blackwater, which I was side by side with them in Iraq. So that nature in itself is a war zone. And the gathering of intel against us as not only just indigenous people, but the other people that were there to support the cause. Clear objective was to stop the pipeline, and that's due to potential leaks and the harmfulness of that would occur there.
Why go from Standing Rock to Little Creek, Iowa? Why travel to Iowa and set up a camp here?
As I first went into Standing Rock, I was fairly ignorant on a lot of things. just basic facts of the pipeline. As I was requested to bring supplies down, I started to understand that the fight here in Iowa has been going on for quite some time, with over 500 arrests and 30% of the pipeline going through Iowa. So to me, it made sense to be a supporter as I went out there to support the people fighting the pipeline, and then to come out here and then continue as well.
Christine, tell us about Indigenous Iowa, which is, I understand, made up mostly of Native Americans who live in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we've had a lot of support from local Native American people that have been living in Iowa for some time. We've done a lot of work with local Meskwaki people. We basically strive to fight environmental and social injustice, because the two are very much linked.
You're the founder of Indigenous Iowa.
Yes.
When did it start?
About a year ago. Recently, there's been a lot of attention on the pipeline, and because it's Iowa and the pipeline does go through Iowa, a lot of people have been asking questions and wanting to know more and help support us.
What nation are you from?
Myself, I'm Plains Cree Salto of the George Gordon First Nation. That's mm-hmm. in Canada, in Saskatchewan.
And what, but you grew up here in Iowa?
No, I've only been in Iowa for 10 years.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yep.
I just wanted to be able to provide a space, and not just a space, a physical space, but a place where we would be able to provide an Indigenous resistance to the cause as well in Iowa. I do believe it's so important to continue the fight here, because people spent a year of their lives in Standing Rock. There's the money, there's the time, there's the energy, the resources that went into this fight. And then prior to that, in Iowa, people were fighting, like I said, since November 2014. And in Iowa, there has been, you know, over 500 arrests that people don't know about, because we never got the media attention and the financial backing that was received in Standing Rock. And not just a responsibility to my relatives at Standing Rock, but to the people of Iowa. Not just like the people that I've been fighting here for the cause, but to all the people of Iowa, to protect the waterways, to protect the land. Because I don't think a lot of people realize the damage that can be done if this pipeline does leak. And also, I don't think they realize how inopportune this pipeline really is, because the pipeline goes from the northwest tip to the southeast tip, and Iowa hosts 30% of it, so it hosts the larger percentage of pipeline than the other three states that it goes to. And the oil just flows right through. There's no economic benefit to it. Why are we letting this all happen for the gain of, like, these extremely rich individuals and take people's land through eminent domain, you know, abuse eminent domain, because it's not for the greater good that this pipeline went through Iowa? Why allow something like that to happen and endanger it, and then also, in the process, endanger the land? Because this pipeline is not an ordinary pipeline. It's massive. And it ships 500,000 barrels of crude. I mean, if that was to leak, the results would be devastating. And if you're forward-thinking, if you're thinking, you know, to the future right now with climate change, we have to preserve the integrity of this land. California provides one-third or two-thirds, I can't remember, of the United States' produce. And it's not doing okay. They've just gone through a severe drought, and now it's flooding in certain areas. I mean, climate change is really making life chaotic right now for farmers all over the world. And Iowa is actually doing really well in terms of agriculture. So why would we want to put in harm's way one of the leading producers?
So what would you want the person listening to this show to know? What is your message at this point?
I would really like Iowans to be incited to want to make change with the system here. I think the Iowa Utilities Board is corrupt, and I think that we need to change that. I think that it'd be great if they would contact their local representative and complain about the Iowa Utilities Board, the fact that they have abused eminent domain. I would like them also, if they wanted, to write a local op-ed for their newspaper to let people know what's going on. to come to the next Iowa Utilities Board meeting, I think, which is July 11th. They're held in Des Moines, and go to the next meeting. And then you're allotted 2 minutes to speak. Everybody who comes can just sign up. So, I mean, I kind of envision sometimes, like, you know, 200 people showing up and signing signing up to talk for 2 minutes to testify, basically, about why we think that there is actually no benefit to this pipeline in Iowa. Because basically, it just runs from the northwest tip to the southeast tip, goes under two major waterways that affect millions and millions, I mean, 20 million or more on each waterway on the Mississippi and the Missouri. It affects their water supply. And it goes under a lot of waterways itself as well in Iowa. It crosses very important agricultural land. This is not good. If there is a spill, we would be without drinking water very quickly. And then what? And also, you know, wherever it spills, that would be a huge area that would be contaminated, and we would lose a massive amount of cropland. And considering what's going on right now with climate change, why would we do that? Because, you know, we're having trouble in California with droughts and flooding. So why would we also go to another state that is still functioning quite well in terms of growing food for our nation? And why would we go and try to harm that? So
we're running out of time. Lakash, any last words before we end the show?
Let's be aware and organize. And I understand that it gets difficult with our individual schedules to maybe attend these rallies or different things like that. But like it was mentioned before, there's motions that have been filed that if we write into the Iowa Utilities Board, we still have the power. We are the people, you know. And so regardless of this macro government, we are the power. And follow our dollars, you know, put our dollars in the right. Let's start investing along with the divestment of these banks who do support the fossil fuel industry, as it is a depleting resource, and invest wisely, whether it's renewables or, I mean, organics. You know, all these things are good now and they're attractive. So let's get in there and do that. Stay focused on our next seven generations.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Christine Nobis and Lakasha from Indigenous Iowa, and this has been Local Talk. I've been your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Kate Potok. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday. Thank you.